in 2013, on my little brother's birthday, I was having a cigarette and listening to a podcast on my estate. And two police officers were, I don't know, they wanted to detain me. They were trying to ask me questions, but they had no right to even talk to me. And they were very aggressive and put their hands on me and tried to tell me that I had to stay there and all that kind of stuff. But if you notice the put their hands on me part, they assaulted me unlawfully with no reason. So from then on, it became an unfortunate incident for everyone because I'm not down to, you don't put your hands on me ever, especially when you're a fascist flipping scumbag in a uniform who thinks that they have power over another human being when I've done nothing. So anyway, I was arrested and battered in front of loads of people on my estate. One of them filmed it. And that was arrest number one.
That was Awate speaking. Awate is a rapper living in Camden, London, who is also an immigrant from Saudi Arabia. He moved to the UK when he was only young. Awate is best known for being an up-and-coming rapper, but he's also become known for having a voice to speak out against the rise of discrimination by the Metropolitan Police and by the government. He has also written for The Guardian about Grenfell, police brutality, and something called the 696 form. In this week's episode, I will share with you some of the things Awate told me in an interview which I thought would be about an up-and-coming rapper, but turned into a portrait and a history of what it's like to be black and to live in London. I'm Brendan Duggan from Shout Out UK. This is The Voices Podcast.
I am Awate. I'm a rapper. I make music. I am now increasingly someone who works in admin because I'm a self-employed musician, an independent artist at the moment. I always have been. In terms of who I am, I'm an Eritrean. I was born in Jeddah in Saudi Arabia on the 29th of May 1991, which is the same day that my country Eritrea was liberated after 30 years of war. My name, Awate, means victory in the Tigray language, which is one of nine languages we have. And I was named after the founder of the Eritrean Liberation Front, Hamid Idris Awate. So me and my mum came to Camden, to a council estate in the middle of London called Maiden Lane in 1993 when I was two.
Why did you decide to move?
Because the newly formed Eritrean government were being allowed by the Saudi Arabian government to disappear people from Saudi Arabia. And due to the fact that my family's political alignments were with a group that didn't win the Eritrean Liberation War, because there was a civil war that happened in between, meant that we were just constantly on the run. Both of the schools I went to were multicultural state schools in the middle of London. Like a mix, maybe, a lot of people on free school dinners, but a lot of people from around the world. And that increased as time went on as well, starting from the mid-90s to when I left school. But on the estate, for example, there was one Eritrean family. And I don't know, maybe I was a kid who knew who they were. Like, I knew I was a refugee, I knew I wasn't from Britain, because I had to relearn English. I had to learn English. And I had to learn English at the time when other people were learning English as well, but I knew that it was I knew I already spoke Arabic, so that was a bit weird. My first memories were in Britain. I got a lot of racist abuse, both from classmates and from teachers who would back them up. So I got excluded a lot. My only understanding or experience of overt fascism as a child, I didn't see it on TV. I saw it two doors down. The family who were in the NF were two doors down. Whenever I'd come out of the house, they'd be sitting on their porch. If you can call it a porch, it's weird. It's kind of strange to describe the architecture of my estate. But yeah, they'd be sitting out there, and then they'd just chase me and throw stones at me and call me Afro, call me the M-word, and call me loads of stuff. My estate is such a community place that has been neglected and whatever, and we can talk about the nickname for it is Alcatraz because of how dangerous it was and all that kind of stuff.
Imagine growing up in a country where no one was like you. No one spoke like you, had the same history as you. No one spoke the same language as you. Even the other kids who looked like you told you otherwise. For Awate as a kid, even the idea of being black was corrupted.
There are so many different concepts to unpack here. Blackness, for example, a lot of the time you're shown one idea of blackness. In the United Kingdom, it was mainly Black Caribbean, and specifically Jamaicans were like the default black people. And as West Africans started to come to prominence and we started to see them and hang out with them because they were in our class and our friends, and started to see a few West Africans on television, the similarities due to the transatlantic slave trade between West Africans and Caribbean people meant that that was blackness, and East Africans weren't seeing that much as black. We'd have certain things even in secondary school with people saying that we weren't black. I wasn't black, I was Somali. So if you unpack that and the countless, I mean, how many mistakes are in that statement? Number one, Somalia is in Africa, it's an East African country, the people are black. Number two, I'm not Somali, I'm Eritrean. And number three, Eritreans are black also. So those are the kind of things that I felt from that side. And I'd say that because I'm thinking, how come they didn't back me up when I was getting chased and being called Afro? Like on the first day of school, you say, hi, my name's Awate, I'm a refugee. Like, you just know that, and then boom, everyone's already isolated you. And in secondary school in year seven, like I said, hi, my name's Awate, I'm a refugee. A few weeks later, one of my mates just shouted, yo, you refugee. But he said it with like mad hate in his voice. In primary school, I just read everything. Like when everyone else is reading Biff and Chip, in like year one, year two, my parents had bought the Encyclopedia Britannica because some guy knocked on our door and my parents were like, oh, books, that sounds great. And I think we're still paying it off to this day. I got 13, 14, I got super into black literature. And mainly like nonfiction, so stuff on African history and African civilizations, different ones. There's a lot there, from Sheikh Anta Diop, Chancellor Williams, Ivan Van Sertima, like Malcolm X, and just stuff on civil rights and politics and just black consciousness. Yeah, I mean, I just read everything, like non-fiction and factual stuff on like my mum's nursing books, my dad's law books. I just wanted to read words. I just wanted to just scan through them and see if I could understand stuff. And then I'd look up words in the dictionaries and try and understand what the definitions are. And then obviously I got into like the children and teen fiction in when I was in year five, so I think I was 10, the school started a creative writing, a gifted and talented program, and we had a creative writing workshop. Then the poetry happened, and creative writing, and then essentially when I was in year seven, the first year of secondary school, 11, 12, I heard hip-hop properly for the first time. I got given an album at a proper important time, 50 Cent's Get Rich or Die Trying, and that changed everything. From then, I became a rapper. I turned the the poems I was doing, I was like, oh, that's the same as this rap stuff, but this rap stuff is a lot better. And you can tell that it's a lot harder. I want to do that. And it's a black art form. And look at this. This guy got shot 9 times and now he looks super muscly and powerful. So I think some of that hyper-masculinity probably appealed to me as someone who lived in like a violent area and was always around the violence. I kept having to fight bullies at school and that kind of stuff. So I wanted that as a protection, as some sort of armor for my self-esteem. I just don't. I can't imagine relinquishing any control. Everyone knows when one card's down, many will fold. And I stay strapped with plenty of flows, just in case I encounter one of many of foes. I am very morose, even though around me there's no Henny to toast with. Note this, I am still here posted. Can't turn me away with a swarm of locusts. And I never do what the most did. See me land punchlines while I am coasting. Last line was very sick. I embellished nearly everything that Nye Bevan did. And I'm breaking into heaven quick. Happiness is open for business, none of your business. Happiness is a warm plate of yeah. Happiness is naked in the shadow, skin, blood and arrow, red, blue, yellow, black. As Awati grew up, he kept rapping, recently releasing an album called Happiness. But there was one thing he couldn't escape. That was the transparent racism that seemed to be embedded in the walls around him. Over the 4 years before his album released, Awati fought 4 court cases against the Metropolitan Police, one of which he described at the beginning of the episode. Then, in the aftermath of the Grenfell fire, in which 71 people lost their lives, a fundraiser was put together in order to raise money for the victims who lost their homes. The fundraiser was to feature rap, hip-hop, trap, and bashment music. The event was soon cancelled because the manager described the music as crap and said it would attract a poor demographic. Whilst there was lots of outrage over this news, Awati was one of the first to point out that this is nothing new for the London rap scene. Here's Awati. There was meant to be a Grenfell fundraiser at a bar in East London, in the newly trendy East London. And the bar had cancelled it when they'd found out that the music that was being played would be trap, Afro beats and dancehall and grime and stuff like that. And they sent an email saying, we don't want people of those sorts of people coming to our night, essentially. Which then led to backlash, and then the manager who sent the email apologized or whatever. It's not a one-off. I think a lot of people with that incident were shocked because it was a fundraiser for Grenfell, but what they failed to see was that it happens all the time. Take the manager at his word. He said it's because he doesn't want those kind of people, and that's an issue that happens a lot. In London and the United Kingdom with music venues and the police having a huge role in the destruction of entire, not just individual artists and groups' careers, like the So Solid crew and nearly Giggs, who is now back to being allowed to perform in the UK to sell out venues, but destroying entire sub-genres. In the 90s, a lot of rave culture was destroyed by the police. And in the 2000s, you know, garage and grime were being persecuted, and the police, in conjunction with tabloid right-wing media and press, demonizing people. It's the exact same headlines from 20 years ago, from 10 years ago, from 30 years ago, when people were talking about punk and ska or whatever, like, nothing has changed. The press and the police are just as quick and just as eager to destroy youth culture, and to, because it's celebratory, like, even if it's not political overtly, like it's a product of politics. And when it's racialized as well, when it's black people, it's not good. They don't want that to happen. And then you mix those institutional, but institutional reasons with just like just every day, the fact that everyone's a fucking racist and they don't want black people to win, and the fact that a third of the venues in London have been closed in the last 10 years due to property development and gentrification, and the fact that a lot of venues have turned into bars or restaurants and that kind of stuff as well. They've changed their business models and whatever, and due to licensing laws and the police's 696 form.
The 696 form was somewhat of a risk assessment that police would ask venues to fill out before an event. The form inquired about many aspects of the event, but also the ethnicity of the audience and performers. It allowed police to target certain genres of music and gave police the power to decide whether an event would or would not take place.
But 696 is gone now, right? Sadiq Khan got the police to withdraw it, I think earlier this year or late last year. But are we seeing more gigs? No.
Have you ever faced that type of police pressure? Like, do you have like an example you could tell me?
So I've got one example of it. Actually, I've got a few. I've got a few examples of it directly happening. But like one example of it directly happening was I was doing a gig. In 2014, it was the last ever gig at University of London Union, and the venue would be putting on a gig, and it was the last one of it being democratically run, because that year the university's chancellor had dissolved it. He dissolved the union for the consortium, which was insane, and there were a lot of things happening trying to stop that. There was a gig being put on. It was the last gig ever when it was being democratically run, and it was a benefit for 286 anti-fascist protesters who were arrested in September of 2013. I should say at this point, the benefit was not to give money or pay the fines for any of those people, but it was to pay for the support that we were giving to each other. So a lot of the times, a lot of people would have to meet, and 286 people were arrested, so we'd need a big meeting hall and to pay for refreshments and stuff like that, because it's illegal to pay people's fines for them. So if the police think that the gig was to pay people's fines, it wasn't. One of the DJs was called up by the feds and told not to perform, and he was told that it was a bunch of anarchists, and all of his other gigs, they'd put pressure on. We've seen here that you've got 17 dates that you're doing. At the moment, you've already announced, you know, you're a DJ, you do a lot of nights, you know. We're going to tell every venue you're a troublemaker, and, like, you know, we suspect you of stuff, and that you've done this, you've gone against the police. Like, police, they called up every promoter and said, no, I've seen that you've booked him and you've put a poster out. You're not booking him. If you do, we're going to come to you. Like, any incident that happens, we're turning up late, we're making sure there's a death will happen on your premises. Or we'll make sure that, you know, the council is serious with you when it comes to your license being renewed. We'll make sure the way that every single venue, like, waters down drinks and takes the money on the side, we'll actually catch you for that. Like, harassment, making sure young black people who want to make money legally can't do that. So they cancelled. So that's just one direct example of it happening at a gig that I was at. I've got a few more since, but they're too recent to be able to talk about.
And what kind of effect does this have on the community? Like, your community?
It means that black kids get killed in East London, in South London, in North London. And there's no hub. There's nowhere for people to come and mourn together and talk together and to, you know, give each other, like, therapy about the loss. But then also to talk about what we're going to do. And how can we as a community demand for accountability and demand that the person is remembered? And that's an extreme side, but then also that's the kind of thing that could happen if we had somewhere. On a daily level, it just means that the community suffers because your high street in your multicultural area, in my high street in my multicultural area, is full with bars, just like bars that are meant for rich people, essentially, that aren't for the community. You can change stuff, you can stop like bad stuff from happening, but yeah, the damage has already been done completely.
My final question to Awati was, what is the state of rap like now? Despite everything I've heard, his answer was surprisingly optimistic.
How do I see the state of it? So the reason why it's a lot healthier is because people started companies like FBTV, Link Up TV, GRM Daily, Boy Better Know. So Skepta and JME brothers had to set up their own companies because they were excluded. Everyone set up their own company, but they, a lot of the time, they're not even thinking it's their own company. They're just doing it, and then they're having to learn on the way, learn how to do accounting, learn how to do the marketing, learn how to do all the admin stuff, learn how to work with PR. It's because we were completely excluded. So now you're starting to see the fruits of it.
Voices is a production by Shoutout UK. It's produced and hosted by me, Brendan Duggan. Big shout out to our founder, Matteo Bergamini. And thank you to my interviewee, Awate. Awate is going on tour. Here are his dates.
I have been told that I am a great performer. And if you're listening to this, and you're listening to this before the end of May, then come see me. I'm going to be in Bristol on the 23rd of May, Manchester the 25th of May, in Manchester the 24th, Leeds on the 25th of May, and I'll be in Glasgow on the 26th.
And thank you for listening.